Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 236 for April 4th. GM's defect. What did Barra know and when did she know it? Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Mr. Gary Vasilash, good to see you.
John, how are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty good.
Good, good.
We got Mike Austin from Popular Mechanics joining us tonight. And Mike, great having you here.
Thanks for having me.
It's you.
Hi, Gary.
Good. Big week.
Big week. Big week. And we got to start out with the Mary Barra stuff because, oh, my God, I think it's going from bad to worse. I don't know how you guys read it, but what I thought would have been just an uncomfortable situation, I think, is turning into a disaster.
It doesn't look good. And I was a little curious. Did you notice that Mark Royce was sitting behind her looking dyspeptic the entire time? I mean, it was just so uncomfortable to watch him.
But, I mean, he's never been happier to not get that CEO job, I'm sure, than that day.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, but I saw this piece on MSNBC where they basically took her no comment, no comment, no comment, and splice them all together.
No.
Oh, my God. I mean, it was endless. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you walk the line. You know, in a Senate hearing, you don't want to say anything incriminating, and you want to deflect as much as possible so they don't nail you on anything, because it is kind of like a firing squad. But, yeah, she went way too far. It just made it the whole situation look worse.
Well, you're right. I'm sure they trained her. In fact, I think they overtrained her, as a matter of fact. It was almost like she was trying to think, oh, yeah, what was I supposed to say when they asked me this? But what I was disappointed in is Mary Barra did not come across as a confident and in-command kind of executive. She seemed out of her league, she seemed uncertain, and did not convey the gravitas that I think the CEO of General Motors needs to convey. And that's when I think the feeding frenzy really started.
I was really shocked, too, with the preparation. All those answers, I watched the House, most of the House hearing, and all of those answers, you're watching her answer and say, no comment, that's why we have, I don't know that information yet, and you're like, how do you not know this? Whoever was in charge of briefing you failed you miserably.
Right. Well, that one congressperson from Colorado who points out, wait a minute, this isn't the briefing book that General Motors gave us.
Yeah.
You don't know the answer to this question?
Yeah. Well, two things I thought were really damning, like you say. Well, what did she know and when did she know it? What Mary said in the House testimony and even in the Senate stuff was, I didn't learn of the specifics of this cobalt ignition switch defect until January 31st. But later, under pressure, I think it was from Senator Claire McCaskill, who really impressed me, as a matter of fact, from Missouri. She admitted that, I've got it right here in my notes, she almost sounded like Sergeant Schultz. She knew nothing. But she then admitted that she had heard about an analysis of the cobalt in December. So I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. You didn't know anything about this recall until the end of January, but you were told something in December. And I'm surprised nobody in the hearings pounced on this. Why were you told something about the cobalt? What was this analysis? And that tells me they knew something was going on in December. And so now the blogosphere and beyond the blogosphere, I've talked to some serious thinkers in this business. They all believe Akerson knew this was coming, and that's why he gave her the job.
Well, the Ray DiGiorgio thing, the engineer who had something to do with the engineering change, he testified in a lawsuit in, I think, April 2013, and he was being represented by a lawyer provided by GM. You're telling me that lawyer didn't report anything from that hearing anywhere up? Like, someone else had to know about that.
Well, that was the other interesting thing that happened in the Senate hearings. McCaskill jumped exactly on that point. And so up to now, the whole thing has been what happened with engineering and who was reporting what or not reporting what up the chain of command in engineering. McCaskill flipped that completely and said, where was legal in this? Who, to your point, who did not report this? Or did they report this? And then she got Mary Barr to admit that the general counsel, the top lawyer at GM, Mike Milliken, has not briefed her on all the lawsuits that GM is facing on this. And that was a stunning admission. And Mary came off as saying, oh, I'm just trying to get the parts out. And it was like, boy, this is not what the CEO should be saying.
Well, I mean, let's be fair to her, though. I mean, okay, so who among us would be capable of dealing with a Senate or a House panel questioning us relentlessly? I mean, what is it that we think suddenly makes her, or anybody else for that matter, capable of doing this?
Gary, I wanted to elbow her out of the way and say, let me answer these questions.
Well, I know, but, see, but the point is, that, I mean, but if we just think about her background, and we think
right.
about where
no,
she
right.
came from.
No, you're
I mean,
right.
it's not like she was a professional executive like, you know, so if Dan Akerson was there, I mean, he would seem to have the gravitas. But, I mean, if we go back in time and we think about the testimony of Nardelli and Wagner
and even Mullally
to a certain degree. I mean, those guys came off looking like amateurs. Let's face
right.
it. I mean, they were wearing suits and they had ties on. But I mean, so I give her a break on some of that. And, you know, and to the point of what legal told her didn't tell her. OK, so she's had the job for what, 3 months now and not even that. And there are a multitude of things that she's being briefed on. And, you know, so this whole issue was probably, you know, under the radar, some trying to keep it down, not a big deal, until it blew up. And then suddenly she's got to, you know, get a cram course on this stuff. This doesn't make any of it right, of course. And I mean, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show just did a vicious, hilarious thing on
What did he do? Because I've seen many references to that on Twitter and online, but I didn't see what.
Well, so basically he breaks down the, you know, the timing of when the cars came out, when the problem was discovered, and how they took 4 years to do a study. And he's like, 4 years to do a study? And then he's wrapping it up, saying basically, and what is her solution? That's right, to take all the other keys off of your key ring, and that will solve the problem. And so the real issue is not the car, it's the fact that you own a house and you have house keys. And I mean, it was just really made General Motors look absurd, you know, talking about the fix may have cost them 59 cents, but somebody said the 59 cents was too much, and you know, of course that's too much. But then he says, but you know what? They could probably find that in the car seats in change. That would be more than, you know, I mean, it's just how absurd the whole thing is.
I have a little bit of sympathy for GM, though, because it's, you know, like back then, I don't think anyone imagined that it would turn into, you know, that it would turn into a fault that would cause possible fatal accidents. And back then, that was the way that everyone did business, but especially GM. They were counting pennies. I'd be like, you know, we're only changing the things that we absolutely have to change. And, yeah, looking back at it now, you see all this really incredibly stupid stuff, like accepting parts that were out of spec, rejecting a 59-cent change, but...
Yeah, I don't know. To me, I have problems with it because the engineers caught this way early on. The engineers caught this in PPAP, right? And in 2001, they go, hey, there's a defect with this thing. And it wasn't approved then. And then there was the suggested changes, and they were rejected. And then a change did get made, and a part number was not changed. So somebody deliberately tried to sneak this through the system. And I think there's going to be criminal charges on in fact, there was another senator who brought that up. Ron Johnson from Wisconsin got Mary Barra to admit that you had to have deliberately tried to override the system to do a design change without generating a new part number. And whoever approved that, and I don't think it's going to be this DiGiorgio guy. I think he's too low ranking to have this in his lap. We'll see. Mm-hmm. I think it goes farther up the chain.
Well, and then, you know, where's Wagner and Akerson in this? Are they going to get called into the Senate?
I'll bet $1 million they do. I think Lutz is going to get called in. I think Jim Queen. I think Lori Queen. Gary, you and I offline have talked about that. Lori Queen was the VLE, the vehicle line executive on that program. Her husband, Jim Queen, the vice president of engineering. I think all those people are going to get hauled in.
And then you've got to, you know, take into account this whole issue of, I mean, does Delphi have any responsibility in this as the supplier of the part? Does the bankruptcy provide protection for General Motors? And, oh, yeah, Delphi went through bankruptcy, too, at about the same time. So, I mean, they've got there's a bankruptcy there. I mean, so there are a lot of factors that are involved in this thing. And I noticed today that one of the lead law firms that sued Toyota for its problems, and according to this company, Hagens Bierman, which recently settled the $1.6 billion case against Toyota, is now going after General Motors.
But that's a billion-six class action for lost value, right?
And so, yeah, this is not the fee that
the Toyota Justice Department
right.
slapped them with.
So this is completely separate. And so these people have filed a class action suit, seeks to recover from General Motors minimum statutory damages of $250 for each owner, which alone totals more than $350 million and could go higher, along with punitive damage for the willful nondisclosure of critical safety information on behalf of owners of affected vehicles.
But here's something interesting. In digging into all this, I contacted Automotive Lease Guide, which tracks residual values, and Kelley Blue Book and Black Book, and said, so are you guys seeing any reduction in residual values of these cars affected by the recall? None whatsoever. In fact, was it ALG or was it, no, I think it was Kelley Blue Book, went back and dug up for me the last 6 weeks of auction data on the Cobalt and the HHR, and they said, in point of fact, the value has gone up in that time, not down at all. So
that may be a lagging indicator.
Also,
isn't
part of that that they're at a low level that's basically stable, that can't really go down or up?
Well, the problem is, ever since the collapse in the market in 2008, 2009, it's easing right now, but there's a shortage of good used cars and a bigger shortage of entry level. They're in the hottest demand right now. And because of that, all boats are rising, including these recalled cars. But what I want to know is, will the courts, if this holds true, it could change, but if your car has in fact gone up in value during this period, how can you possibly sue GM for damages that you've lost value in your car? I don't think you can. But I learned back when I studied constitutional law when I was in university, I don't understand how the law works, and what makes sense in my mind, the courts can go and do whatever the hell they want, it seems.
Sure.
So GM could still be hit with damages on this, but I'm telling you, as of right now, the latest data shows no reduction in value of those cars.
Right, and I mean, and one might make the argument that if we look at GM sales in total last month,
they did better than Honda.
They were up.
They did better than Ford.
But they're down year to date for the first quarter compared to last year. So
yeah, I keep saying because of the weather, the whole funny business of so much of the country being socked in by so much snow and ice and cold that I don't think we can read too much into that.
So,
and that's a great segue into what do you think about March sales?
When you were talking about ALG, I thought we were going to segue into something else.
Oh, well, let's go to that. Yeah, and then we'll get to sales. So we just, as we're all driving in here to do the show tonight, learned that John Krafcik, former CEO of Hyundai Motor America, has been named to the board of directors of TrueCar, which owns ALG
right.
Auto Lease Guide.
And as we think about TrueCar, remember they hired Larry Dominique, who had been the vice president of product planning for Nissan.
Yes, yes. In fact, I got to say, Larry Dominique was one of the guys I talked to say, can you tell me if the GM recalled cars have been hit? And Larry was the guy who said, no, as a matter of fact, they're going up in value.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but the thing with Krafcik is, everybody's been wondering where he's going to show up. And, we'll have our Hyundai guest here shortly, but we won't talk about that. He's been added to the board, okay? It's not the job he's going to be taking. He's going to have to do something. He will be doing something. And
at a car company.
I don't know.
What else would he do?
Supplier company?
possibly.
Would we be surprised? I mean, I don't think this is going to happen, but would we be surprised that given Apple's announcement of CarPlay, that he would go to a company like Apple?
Ooh, what a thought. Hmm.
But let's take it even further and say to yourselves, okay, who haven't we heard from in this whole space? And that would be Samsung. And where's Samsung based?
Korea.
And where's Hyundai based?
Yeah.
You know, so I could, I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, and if you think about it, okay, could he actually be on the board of TrueCar and get a job at a OEM? Wouldn't there be some sort of a conflict there?
It depends on the OEM job he gets. Maybe he leaves the board. I mean, I see him, you know, as this engineer, as this product guy who loves being around cars, loves cars. Like, I had a couple exchanges with him after he, I guess, retired. And, you know, he mentioned that he...
Nice to retire at 52.
He mentioned that he can drive his Porsche every day now, which he couldn't do when he was at Hyundai because he had to drive a company car. And it, to me, he seems like the kind of guy that's got to get around product. So I would, you know, I thought maybe he'd end up back at Ford, but, you know, that probably wouldn't happen.
I think there's a lot of bad blood there, at least on the part of the Ford people. I don't think they want Kravchuk back.
But, I mean...
And he likes the weather out in Southern California. He and I have...
Well, so then who's out in California? I mean, I see him in sort of this Mark Royce-like product guy. That's the persona I see him as.
Mm-hmm. But. Yeah, but I can't see... After being CEO, admittedly of a subsidiary, you know, where you don't have total control, but nonetheless, having the title CEO to then go back to do product planning, I don't see him taking that. I got to believe that Hyundai said, John, here's a bunch of money. You've been great to us, but we're going to do something different here. Oh, and oh, by the way, you cannot go to work for another car company for another year. My guess is he's got a one-year non-compete clause.
My guess is in 2 weeks we'll know the answer.
Why do you say 2 weeks? Oh, okay. Good.
I don't know the answer, but I think...
You think we'll hear something?
Yes. New York show.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll bet you mm-hmm. he's there.
So, segueing on to car sales.
Okay, back to car sales. What I was amazed with is Bloomberg does a poll of all the auto analysts to... give their sales forecast about a week before the month closes. And all of them were predicting pretty much a decline. They were saying the SAAR was going to come in at 15.7, I think. And in point of fact, it came in at 16.3 and was the best March in 7 years or something like that. So it was interesting to see how the analysts got it wrong. But I was talking to some car dealers on Tuesday, and they were saying, man, it was like the last week of the month, things just exploded. Now, I'm talking locally, and the weather got a little bit better here. But they said Monday night, the last day of March, it was a madhouse. And they said they were almost turning customers away, that it was just such a crazy thing. And I think that's what happened is, you know, the analysts tracked what was going on. And then the last week of the month, pow, things just exploded.
And Monday was a nice weather day, and people got out of their shells and came out and bought a new car.
I mean, you have some refund checks rolling in. I mean, how much of it do you think was just people saying, all right, I've had enough of the weather, I can't hold off buying any longer?
I think that was a lot of it. I think April sales are going to be phenomenal.
Well, because if you look at it, January sales were down, February sales were flat, and then sales for March were up, or brought the year up to like 3.some%. So, I mean, they were considerably strong. And so you got to say, okay, what's the difference between January and February and March? Well, things started getting a little better in different parts of the country. So you had that, you know, pent-up demand that you might have otherwise not had if we'd had historical weather patterns.
Right.
But, there were a lot of things that, I mean, really came as a surprise to me as I was looking at the numbers. I mean, remember we had the Impala in here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already losing steam.
And, is it
yeah,
really?
Yeah, and that surprised me quite a bit, that it's down 8.9% from last March, and it's down 15.8% compared to last first quarter.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
wow.
Really not
that's
good.
That's not good.
And so that's...
How's Avalon doing? Because that's a direct competitor.
It's also gone down, which I
thought was... So that would suggest the whole segment's going down.
It's really strange to me because it seems to me that, little cars, you know, like little tiny cars, are doing awful, and big cars are doing awful. And you're somewhere in between, and you know, Fusion's doing fine, Malibu is up.
Camry was blistering.
And, Altima outsold Accord, as you mentioned.
Right.
Last month they outsold Camry, mm-hmm. so... They're obviously doing something right over at Nissan.
Yeah, lots of incentives.
There could be that. Passat was up. I mean,
Lord Almighty!
I mean that is just like the hugest
Volkswagen. Boy, those guys are going nowhere. Jeez.
And okay, so Passat.
Have they quelled the dealer revolt yet?
So here's the thing that I said: not one car company saw its sales go down, but Volkswagen was only up 0.1%. The worst of everybody.
Well, but I mean, if you look at what they've been doing these past few months, though, I mean, the Beetle convertible was like the only thing that was in positive territory, and at least this month they have some Jetta and Passat sales. But the thing that I was really surprised to look at Passat so far, so from January through the end of March, they sold 24,283 Passats. Okay. And I thought, what would be a fair comparison? There were 37,515 Optimas sold.
Wow.
And 40,253 Sonatas sold. So everybody thought that, you know, the Passat, the American Passat would be the big thing. And I mean,
it hasn't worked.
It's not working at all.
Well, but it's going on something, you know, 4 or 5 years old now. It's at the end of the product cycle with no...
The Passat, I think, in the Passat.
I wouldn't say it's at the end. It's matured. It's
but
like,
so is the Sonata.
Yes.
Okay, that's going to be replaced, you know, in a couple
this
of
year,
months.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and so.
But when's the Passat going to be replaced?
Who knows?
Yeah,
a couple of years.
Right.
It's not going to get better.
No.
But I mean, but I mean, that's as good as it gets. I mean, this is the real positive for those guys. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I just don't get that.
And then there's the controversy on the truck side. Ram versus Silverado. And depending on whose numbers you go by, Ram either outsold the Silverado or it did not.
All right, so according to Auto Data, Ram sold 42,532 units versus Silverado with 42,247 units, or for those who are not doing the math, it's 285 units
ahead.
Delta.
Ram ahead has never happened in the history of the Ram.
Right.
That it outsold Silverado.
Correct.
Or maybe you could say Silverado undersold Ram, although Ram had a hell of a month. But if you go by Ward's numbers, Ram was behind the Silverado by some 600 units. And, you know, car companies have done this in the past where somebody reports and they go, okay, here's what we sold then. And... you know, remember, was it around 1999 or so, there was a situation where Cadillac...
They had to recalculate.
Cadillac pulled out some funny numbers just so they could say they were ahead of Lincoln.
But those things usually happen at the end of the year, not at the end of the first quarter. I mean, so that's why I would be a little dubious as to whether somebody...
I guess I got to call the guys over at Ward's and say, what's your number and why is the Chrysler number different now? Because the Ward's number and the Chevy numbers were identical, absolutely identical. And the Ram numbers were very generous.
All right, so here's the big number. 999.9% increase. Viper. they sold 67 in... March last year, they sold 3. See, so
they're
Ralph
gaining momentum.
Ralph was here last week. That
they're on fire.
They're on fire right
they
now.
Are. And I just wonder whether these auto data guys calculated things quite correctly here, because they're also saying it was up 999.9% for the year, because so far for the year they've sold 158 versus 4. So.
Going back to trucks, though, I mean, it's kind of a race to the bottom, right? Because F-150, on its way out, is outselling both of those trucks.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you think things are bad at VW. This is a brand-new truck for Chevy, and they're dropping. You know, they're fighting with Ram now, and they can't move them, even with cash on the hood. It's a brand new truck almost.
Sure. It is a brand new truck.
That's bad news.
It is bad. It is bad news.
Well, there are other, I mean, there. You know, another surprise to me was ATS. The Cadillac ATS is going down already, and you know, there was always this notion of it's going to cannibalize all the CTS sales, and CTS is actually up month over month by, you know, last March, this March, and so the new one seems to be selling more, and So ATS was down 13.7% this March versus last March, and it's down 23.9% for first quarter over first quarter. So what's going on with that thing?
Don't know.
I mean, yeah, CTS is new and shiny, but it's so much more expensive. The lease rates are higher. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a mystery.
See, that's what I was wondering about Impala, because if you look at the Impala prices versus what they used to be when, you know, my mom owns an Impala, and, you know, I know she would never buy a new Impala because she couldn't afford it. I mean, just simply couldn't do that. It's that much more expensive. So what do people buy in that segment?
Well, you said the whole segment's down, so they buy a Fusion.
Well, at least we know Avalon.
Taurus is down, and... Yeah. Yeah, you name it, and it's probably down in that segment.
Hey, actually, before we dig even more into this, I think this is a good time to transition. We've got Barry Ratzlaff from Hyundai coming on, and why don't we take a quick break, get him on here, and we'll start talking all about connectivity and telematics and where the heck that's all going. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our good friends at Firestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Well, Barry Ratzlaff, welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Thanks, John. Really happy to be here.
And I said your connectivity and telematics and all that. What's your exact title? Just for the record, sir.
You know, to keep it simple, my job is to make the ownership experience for a Hyundai owner as good as it can be so they come back and buy another one.
That makes sense to me, but you didn't answer my question.
That's predicated on electronics, right?
No, actually, I'm responsible for a dealer service process,
okay,
consumer affairs, which is our call centers and customer support, and telematics, connected vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that weaves together to create a great owner experience.
Meaning people call up the call centers and...
People do.
Telematics.
Yeah, it's related to each other, mm-hmm, right?
Well, I got to tell you, typically Hyundais are the easiest car for me to connect my phone to. It's just boom, boom, done.
You know, we work really hard at that, but we're not perfect, right? It's a struggle for the whole industry because, you know, the Bluetooth standard itself is fragmented a little bit. So it's hard to do right, and we're struggling and working to improve it just like everybody else is. But we think we've done pretty well so far comparatively.
So you guys are now launching BlueLink 2.0.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about BlueLink 1.0 and how it's now transitioned to a whole digit to the left of the decimal point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big leap. So we launched Generation 1 BlueLink in June of 2011 on the Sonata, our highest volume model. You guys were talking about its great sales last month. And we've learned a lot over the last 2 years. We expanded BlueLink across the model lineup. It's available on virtually every vehicle. Everything except Accent, BlueLink is available on now. And we've learned a ton from our customers and the way that process whole works. One of the things we learned is that we need to simplify. And there's some elements of this service that we really wanted to internalize. We depend on an outside telematics service provider previously known as Agero for Generation 1 BlueLink. They've done a great job. They've been a good partner. They're now owned by SiriusXM Satellite Radio. That purchase happened in November of last year. And we're going to continue using SiriusXM services for a variety of things. Nevertheless, for Gen 2, we said we want to do a couple of things. We want to bring that connection between the customer and their car and us in-house. and manage that server and that protocol internally. And we also want to integrate BlueLink into our other customer touchpoint elements. For example, the call center I mentioned earlier. We have a consumer affairs call center that takes calls from customers that are shopping or customers that need help or to answer questions. And previously, the BlueLink calls were going to a different call center, and sometimes customers got caught in a ping-pong game. So we wanted to solve that problem. So Gen 2 BlueLink is integrating BlueLink calls into our single consolidated call center so we can kind of have one-stop shopping for the customer and hopefully provide them broader customer support for all their needs, not just telematics in one bucket and customer support or vehicle questions in another one, but can serve the customer better by bringing all that together.
Barry, I know you work here in the U.S., but Hyundai is a global company. Is this BlueLink available in other markets, and what's Hyundai doing there?
BlueLink is a brand that's used in other markets, the Korea domestic market and China as well. But much like Hyundai approaches selling vehicles in global markets, there's a lot of energy and attention paid to trying to align the products and services with the local market. So the way, while the BlueLink brand exists in other markets, the way the services are offered in that market are completely different.
So is BlueLink a thing or a service? Is it an embedded processor that's on the CAN bus, or is it something that you guys just send into my phone that's mirrored on my screen?
Yeah, I'd say it's more a set of services. Certainly, we have technology built into the car that allows us to communicate to the cloud, so to speak, right, and offer these services. But it's more the off-board side of the equation than it is the onboard side. It confuses people sometimes because we say BlueLink and logos right there on the head unit. And it's hard to differentiate between the two, but it's really the offboard services. BlueLink is based on embedded cellular technology, though, as opposed to using a customer's phone to make the connection. We have a cellular modem built into the car that connects to the server, and that allows us to do some things that you can't do if you're only using a smartphone-based approach.
So, but you have, there are other connected components, like in the Genesis, which is launching BlueLink, or has BlueLink 2.0. Mm-hmm. So how does the connected parts of the Genesis, what does the Genesis have as in terms of connected parts, and how does that relate to, like, the BlueLink brand and those services?
Yeah, it's telematics connected vehicles is really complex, and this is one of the reasons why. It's really about channels. I'll try to make an analogy to the idea of channels. You have AM radio and FM radio, right? And then XM radio. Well, now we have more channels available to connect to the car. Satellite radio, I already mentioned. You can connect through your smartphone to the car. Say, for an example, we use in Hyundai with Pandora. You've got a Pandora app on your car that connects to the head unit. And that is technically not BlueLink, but it's part of the connected vehicle services. Separately, you can connect to the cloud and do a Google POI search through the head unit and through the mirror button. That's going offboard to a server in the cloud to get the information, and that is part of BlueLink. So simplifying all of that is that there's many channels for communicating within and out to the car. Some of them are BlueLink related, some of them aren't, but I'm happy to speak to all of them.
Now, you guys charge money for these services, right?
Some of them we do.
Are you guys making money on this?
You know, that's not really our main goal. I'd say some of them we are and some of them we're not. You know, it's a business and we learn and evolve as we go. Generation 1 taught us a couple of really powerful things. We perhaps were too complex when we went to the marketplace. We had 32 features and three different packages, and you could double your free trial period, and it was a lot to digest. So we listened to our customers, we did some more research, and we found out that customers kind of grouped things into three groups. One is safety and car care-related services. And they really think those kind of things should come with the car. Don't really want to pay for those as a subscription-based
service. So safety meaning if my car crashes, that 911 is automatically notified.
Exactly. Automatic collision notification or emergency assistance available from the car.
Okay.
That type of thing.
And so they want that just...
Kind of want that built in. And the same thing is true of a maintenance alert or monthly vehicle report or a recall alert. These things that are about their car and information for them, they kind of expect that to be, I buy a car, I get that.
Something more advanced than the check engine light.
Right, right. There's another tier of services, And by the way, safety in car care, that's ubiquitous. It applies to everybody. Everybody can benefit from those services. The next tier is what we call a package that is now called remote, and we renamed it to clarify that. It's things like remote start, remote unlock, remote lock. From your smartphone app, you can start your car, unlock it, lock it. It's also stolen vehicle recovery, right, like LoJack or like OnStar can do. These are things that customers told us aren't ubiquitous. They don't apply to everybody. Some people are more interested in them than others. So don't bake it into the price of the car. Don't make us all pay for it. Just offer it to those people that want to pay for it. So that's what we're doing. It's a subscription model. The third tier of services that we offer is a package called Guidance, and it's navigation-related services. And it's in its simplest form, it's a cloud-based point of interest or destination search you can download to your car while you're in the car. It's the easiest way to put a destination into your navigation, actually. Or you can do it again from your smartphone and send it to your car so it's there when you get there. You're in your office and you think, oh, I need to go someplace. You can look it up on your phone and send it to your car and look it up on the web page and send it to your car. So it's a time-saving and convenience feature.
Okay, but you still have a traditional navigation system in your car.
Uh-huh.
So you have the navigation. So instead of sitting in your car and going boop, 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 you're doing this at your home computer or on your iPad or on your phone and then just sending it to the car.
That's correct. That's one of the things it does. So it saves you a little bit of time. You know, it might be seconds, but sometimes seconds matter. It's providing a little bit of value. But it also, from the car, you can press the BlueLink button on the mirror and do the Google Cloud search from the car. And it's just the easiest way to download a destination, as opposed to entering it on your onboard navigation, which you can still do. You can just speak into the cloud and it downloads it to your car. So it's quicker, right?
Mm-hmm. So then there's this third area that it seemed to be building to that people will pay good money for.
So the remote package and the guidance package are things that apply to some people. Some people are interested in and they'll pay for, but they don't really want it built into the price of the vehicle. So that's the way we've structured our Gen 1 telematics program. That's in market today. And we're still finalizing details on exactly how we're going to come to market with Gen 2, even though it's about, you know, just a few weeks away before Genesis goes on sale. Got a couple of I's to dots and T's to cross. But we basically made the safety and car care thing standard for 3 years. When you buy a Hyundai that's equipped with BlueLink, you get that stuff for 3 years. And then remote and guidance are $99 a year on a subscription basis beyond that.
So what do you guys do different than the competitors that says, hey, you know, this is going to influence your buying decision. Our system's better. Our system's easier. What makes you guys, what makes me want to buy a Hyundai because of BlueLink?
I'd say the jury's still out on whether or not a telematics really helps sell cars or not. It's a growing space. Enough people have got telematics or connected offerings in the marketplace now. It might be more obvious if you don't have something. You know, it might be more of a takeaway if your brand doesn't have something. There's some research that shows that our brand opinion has been boosted because of BlueLink, particularly the safety and car care features. People get that. Hyundai's famous for assurance, America's best warranty, roadside assistance. And in fact, in the summer when we launched the Connected Care program, we announced at the New York Auto Show last year, 3 years of these services built into the price of the car. We added that under the umbrella of assurance. So now it's America's best warranty, roadside assistance, and 3 years of connected care. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that enhanced people's opinion of the Hyundai brand. And it's the top of the funnel. It goes from awareness and opinion to consideration to shopping. And it gets fuzzy on whether or not it really is ringing the cash register, so to speak, selling cars. But there's also a lot of benefit on the service retention side. I mentioned these car care features, a maintenance alert. People's lives are busy. A monthly vehicle report. It's my job to make it as simple as possible for you to own a Hyundai. I want to give you the information you need when you need the information and then help you transact on it easily. So this car care stuff, you get a monthly vehicle report. It's an email from your car to you that tells you the condition of your car, the mileage of your car, when your maintenance is due, if there's any diagnostic codes. And it has a really fantastic open rate. It's almost a 50% open rate, which is double the typical service marketing communications. And it's a little bit more than that, right? It's not just an email saying, here's your car needs service. It's a little bit more than that. But people like it. And we've found that it's helped grow our service retention back to dealers. And we know that Polk data and lots of other studies show that a customer who's coming back to the dealer for service is more likely to buy another car from that dealer. So it's a virtuous circle thing. We're really trying to build a relationship with the owner through transparent information, giving them what they need, when they need it, in as painless a way as possible.
So when this email comes and it says, okay, you need an oil change or your tire is rotated or what have you, is there a link to a dealer website to be able to schedule service for that?
There is. And we integrated something a couple of years ago. We started down this journey. We actually use a nationwide integrated appointment scheduling system that integrates into all of our dealers' dealer management systems. And oh, by the way, it's the same one I use at the Blue Link call center and the Consumer Affairs call center and the smartphone app. So you might want to engage through a smartphone app. You might want to use the call center. You might want to press the Blue Link button. All of them are bringing us to the same appointment scheduling solution that helps you connect into the dealer, find an open time slot that matches your schedule, and make it as easy as possible for you to book service.
Mm-hmm. So this alert is not on my screen. I'm not seeing a warning. You need to change your oil immediately. It's an email that's coming to
yes and no.
Device.
Yes, no. There is a message that comes up on the radio that says, maintenance due soon, press the Blue Link button for more information. So we're very mindful of what's the appropriate amount of information to be shown in the car. If the customer chooses to press the Blue Link button after they see that message on the radio, they then hear a message that tells them service is due, ask them if they'd like to talk to an operator to schedule service.
And if they don't push the button?
Nothing happens other than that they've got the information.
But, I mean, the message stays there?
It goes away. It goes away. They don't have to do anything to make it go away.
What kinds of percentage of your service appointments are being made through?
It's still pretty small. I'd say we're in the neighborhood of a little bit less than 10% of our appointments are being made through this ecosystem. And oh, by the way, J.D. Power data shows us that our brand has the highest rate of technology-based appointment scheduling of any brand. And the main reason there is price. When customers call to schedule service, a lot of them want to know price. So we haven't yet been able to cross over the threshold of being able to offer the dealers pricing information through that system. So a lot of them are still preferring to call the dealer, which is understandable.
When I read these white papers or studies by the different consultancies, they all say, the automakers need to learn how to control the content and generate a new revenue stream through all this telematics and all. And that's why I was asking whether you were making any money on it. What's the future of this? Not necessarily for Hyundai, but for the industry in general. Can the automakers really grab hold of any of the content, control that, and price it?
You know, it's really a sexy space, right? People like to talk about the idea of using telematics to interact with the customer and exchange data and potentially use that as a marketing platform. Two points I'd make about that. One is we're a car company, and we want to be a car company, and we want to use that ecosystem to help customers and our dealers and us have a better ownership relationship. Second is that we all already have a smartphone, and all of the apps that you've agreed to on your phone, you've already given other people the ability to track your location and sell you advertising. So I'd argue that there might be people who are more likely to be the ones to really execute in that space, more so than automakers. It's tempting to think about, and it seems appealing. But we're a car company, and we want to work on having a good ownership experience.
You're going to make us all fall out of our chairs here because we hear from other guys that, I mean, telematics is essential, and they're never going to sell another car to somebody under 30 years old that doesn't have a full suite of telematics capabilities. Yeah. And you're saying, well, you just make better cars, and we'll have that stuff too.
It all goes together. I mean, one of the things I'll bring into the mix is Apple CarPlay. So we've announced we're implementing CarPlay. Some people tell me, Barry, why are you doing that? Isn't that competing with Blue Link? It's another channel, right? It's another way for customers to get information. We expect that to be able to sell cars, customers will start demanding their phone be able to integrate with their car. So perhaps if we don't implement CarPlay, we might be at a competitive disadvantage. But more importantly, we actually think it's a good thing. And we've got a good relationship with both Apple and Google to figure out how to do that kind of integration and they're on that roadmap. So for infotainment types of things, right, they're probably going to be better at it than we are. So let's make sure our cars can leverage that ecosystem well to support what our owners are expecting.
So again, for the service and information, so that is integrated in the car, so it's collecting data about the performance, you know, it's getting from the ECU and from various sensors around the car.
Diagnostic codes.
And so all of that information is being collected, and then that is what is accumulated and put into the email that's sent out. So you have that, but then you have this whole other services and entertainment sort of thing over here as well.
Yeah, and that's why connected cars complex. People tend to want to gravitate towards the infotainment side of it and lose sight of the safety and vehicle customer relationship stuff, the diagnostic tools, and both are important, but you have to be able to engage in both parts of that ecosystem. But it's hard to explain all of that in one fell swoop.
But, you know, back to Mike's point, I mean, are there ways for consumers to differentiate between the offerings that the various car makers are providing in terms of this space? I mean, everybody's got something, you know, so whether it's OnStar or MyFord Touch or whatever Audi calls its thing and whatever Mercedes calls its thing and Uconnect from Chrysler. And I mean, so suddenly we have all of these different names and how does consumer sort these things?
Yeah. It's hard for us to figure out, frankly, and we think we found something with Assurance Connected Care that can explain one set of it. The connected vehicle solutions that only use a smartphone, that don't have an embedded mobile device in the car, can't do some things. They can't do remote start. They can't do stolen vehicle recovery, right? So those of us that have that capability, we try to highlight that, and we try to make sure customers know about that. And again, we find those two features in particular are ones that some customers find highly desirable and are more than happy to pay a subscription to have access to.
But you've got the radio on the data radio built into the car, and you've got some form of tracking where, you know, you're getting this report at the end of the month. Does Hyundai have a policy about where the metadata goes and what the privacy issue is of
we do.
Having tracking on a car?
We do, and we don't track, right? We certainly do get data. The monthly vehicle report comes to us, so we can see the mileage of the car. If there's a diagnostic code, we get an alert. We're not following every car around, right? It's nothing like that. But there's snippets of data that are available from time to time, and they do include location, right, where the event occurs. So let me start from a foundation of these services are off until the customer asks us to turn them on. And in fact, very specifically, if a customer says, I don't want anything to do with that ever, we permanently disable the device. We turn it into a brick just to reassure them that we are never going to reach in there and get data without you knowing about it. Right? That's the starting point. It's foundational. Beyond that, when a customer enrolls in the services, we try to be as transparent as we can with them that, yes, the information's coming to us. Yes, we're going to share it with your dealer. Yes, we're going to keep it for a period of time. Our policy is 10 years, life of the vehicle plus 10 years. And frankly, that's a little bit of a placeholder while we figure all this out. I don't think we really are going to need it that long. And to the degree that we learn more, we'll probably start carving that down. Our intention is not to, again, I said we're not trying to be a marketing company. While it seems very appealing to some people talk about how I should be hypothetically selling that data to lots of marketing companies, those other companies don't need to get it from me anymore because you all have smartphones in your pocket that have an app on them where you already gave it away for free.
Well, I was thinking more on the NSA side of things where, you know, law enforcement says there's a warrant out for this person. Mm-hmm. They happen to have a Hyundai. We're going to serve a warrant to Hyundai to get into the cloud and figure out where their car is.
So subpoena, the subpoena rules apply.
Okay.
And situations like that do happen.
Can you take over the nav and direct that guy to jail?
No, we not pass go. Yeah. Do not collect $200.
That's a funny idea. we can remotely disable the car. Mm-hmm. So with law enforcement and only with law enforcement directing our activities, a police report has to be filed. We're contacted by law enforcement. We identify where the car is located. They get on scene. They direct to us whether they want to. If the car is stopped, then we just immobilize it so it can't move. If the car is moving, they instruct to us if they want us to initiate immobilization and slow down the car.
Well, remember with the Boston Marathon bombing, these guys who carjacked the Mercedes, yeah. That's how the cops were able to track them down.
That's right. That's right.
So, but then again, as you point out, you just can't stop a car because the car could be, you know, going down 275, going
right.
80,
right.
And all of a sudden,
right.
And it would be just catastrophic.
Yeah, right. So obviously we have to have very strict controls and protocols over how processes like that get enabled.
Hey, we're getting a whole bunch of questions coming
good.
In here. So I think it's time to get to that part of the show that we call rapid fire. Ben, let it rip. Okay, Barry, first question is from AAH Guest 682. He wants to know, is this a long-term service, i.e., will car buyers in 8 years, used car buyers in 8 years, be able to use these features?
Yes, they will be, I think, in 8 years. There always are generational risks, and the generational risk right now that I think is most applicable is the availability of the 3G cellular network. Right, cellular networks are all transitioning to 4G, and ultimately there will be something else beyond that. So we're dependent on the 3G cellular network for the device that's built into the car today. As long as it's around and the customers want to use the services, they'll be available.
JM1NB says, how can or do you proactively use telematics to help service the customer? For example, say an owner gets a CEL, a cell.
A check engine light.
I should have known that. And the code's a misfire. Can you schedule a service meeting for the customer and check inventory at the preferred dealer to ensure the appropriate parts are in stock, or recommend to the customer a service center that might have the parts?
That's exactly the roadmap we're on, and we're doing most of that today. I'm not quite at the level where I can check dealer inventory for parts, making the match to the check engine light, but we try to overcome that with manual processes. What happens today is the check engine light comes on in the car or any other malfunction indicator light. A message pops up on the radio. Again, it says diagnostic check-in process. Press the blue link button. If you want more information, you don't have to. If you press the blue link button, you hear a recording that describes what that issue is in more detail and gives you guidance if you should come to the dealer today for service or soon or when convenient, and then offers to connect you to an operator who can dispatch roadside assistance or schedule a service appointment for you. In the background, that data is also being sent to your preferred dealer who has an inbox, and they've got people that work the inbox. They'll pull up the inbox, and they have the opportunity manually to pre-diagnose that issue and check their inventory and see if they have a part. But the roadmap we're on is exactly what was asked, is how can we know this part goes with that and ultimately lead to, in the long run, perhaps reprogram your car over the air and save you the trip to the dealer. In the near term, can we just make it a 2-hour service visit instead of a 4-hour service visit?
I love this name that this guy signed in at. Zero Do It Signing. So Zero Do It Signing wants to know, what G-force enacts the 9/11 crash reporting?
I don't know the G-force. It's an airbag deployment.
Yeah.
If the airbags deploy, the car automatically calls the call center.
What I want to say the speed at which airbags will deploy is around 12 miles an hour. Do you know that, Mike?
No, I don't.
It might vary by car, but I want to say a 12-mile-an-hour collision, I think, will trigger an airbag.
I don't know the number. I'd hate to guess.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more than just backing into someone when you're parallel parking.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
Exactly. How does Blue Link protect one from remotely starting a car inside a closed garage?
It doesn't. There's nothing to prevent the owner from doing that. We expect the owner knows where their car is parked, and the owner controls the interaction. There's a user login, password, and PIN. So we expect the user to manage that.
I think you need a PZEV car, because I'm told that if you have a PZEV car and you put it in the garage and close the door and run the engine, it will not kill you.
Yeah, the air gets cleaner somehow.
Well, what I was going to say is there's no logic in the car knowing it's in that remote start state and checking the quality of the intake air.
There's not, but maybe a missed opportunity for us, actually, because with the Genesis...
Mike, you better run out and patent that idea. I think that's a hell of an idea. I'm serious.
With the Genesis, we actually have an air quality monitor, a carbon monoxide monitor inside the vehicle that opens up the dampers and brings in fresh air, but it's not connected to our telematics solution.
Yeah, of course, in China, the engine would never start.
Yeah.
Hey, we've got a couple of phone calls here. Ben, let's bring one in.
Hi, John. This is Frank from Long Island. I have a question for you and your group there. Does anybody know what's going on with the Jeep and the Durango with their brakes? They're having problems with their brakes, and Chrysler says it's just a little part that they're going to cover up with some kind of a covering so that the water doesn't get into it or something. Another question I have is, has anybody seen the price of Hyundais lately? They're not any more bargains with Hyundai. They're starting to become an expensive car. So if you could ask your guest that question also. Thank you so much. You have a great show, and just continue on what you're doing. You're doing a great job.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the call. That's great. The Jeep brakes?
So with the brakes, it's part of the Chrysler had a recall this week, and I think it was 800 and some thousand cars. And, yeah, there's a part on the brake that's... It sounded like it was a very innocuous sort of thing. Bring it in, service it. But anytime I hear brakes, I think, maybe they should be telling people not to drive the car. Do you know more, Gary?
I'm cheating here and I'm looking
it up. I know I heard something about it, but yeah, it had to do with corrosion, water getting into something and corroding something. And I wish I was more up on the details. I'm not.
The automaker will install a shield on the recalled vehicles that protects brake boosters from underwater corrosion. The problem can cause excessive brake pedal firmness. Why would brake pedal firmness be a problem?
Well, you're losing, if it's something's happening to the brake booster, you're losing that assist.
Okay.
So then you have a hard pedal that requires a lot of force to actuate the brakes, which is, you know, for a lot of people, it can be pretty dire. You can't get full braking power.
Okay.
That would be bad.
It says, the brake boosters may be replaced if their capability has been compromised. So you have that. And
I mean, this is just the new era of recall a week, though, right? I mean, any tiny problem, if it's remotely related to safety, I mean, I think it has more to do with the Tread Act than the current GM thing. But every automaker is, maybe you could tell us more about the recall environment.
You know, certainly everything that's going on is appropriately encouraging us all to revisit our processes and make sure we've got robust processes in place. Automobiles are complex pieces of equipment, right? And so it's necessary and appropriate for things like this to take place from time to time, right? So good friends at Consumer Reports, I spend a lot of time with them from time to time, and I like the way that they really reference the idea that from their point of view, recalls are a good thing. Because at the end of the day, it's providing a solution to the customer. Now, do we all think, would it have been great if it could have been preventable? Of course, absolutely. But I think the most important thing is to make sure that that when they're necessary, they're put in place.
You know, and this sort of gets us back a little bit to the whole, you know, Mary Barra GM thing, and I was thinking about it. And if you think about, you know, the culture of companies like Toyota, when you had the andon cord that you'd pull it to indicate we've got a problem here.
On the assembly line.
Stop the line.
Fix the problem.
We've got a problem. And there was always this reticence among, you know, the traditional big three. No, we don't want that sort of thing. We don't want them to stop the line. And you think about that sort of cultural mindset that it's good to raise your hand and say there's something wrong versus... I don't know. We got to ship these cars, you know, that sort of a thing. And I just wonder whether that isn't going to be a fundamental problem that has to get worked out over time.
And I know you're not in sales or marketing, but what do you think about as common of saying, hey, Hyundais are no longer a screaming bargain?
Yeah, you know, it's been a fascinating...
You have a big smile on your face.
Well, it's relatively true. Our prices are really more competitively priced with what I would consider to be tier one brands now, and I think many customers would as well. Up until a few years ago, I don't think Hyundai was ready to compete on that stage with Tier 1 products. And the last 3, 4, or 5 years have really been a fascinating journey for us where we've moved from, being a value brand and being a less expensive option to really, I think, having products that compete at a Tier 1 level. And there's costs associated with that. If you want to have a product that competes at that level, there's cost in the product that needs to be there, right?
Look, the only way you can raise your prices is if there's people still standing in line.
Yeah.
So, and they're only standing in line because they really want the car.
Yeah.
So I think it, if Hyundai's no longer a screaming bargain, that it's only good news for the brand. Maybe not for the people who want to buy them, but it's good news for the brand.
We do still work hard every day to make sure that there is still value. And I think if you look at a content level and the material quality and things like that, we still have an advantage in many areas in terms of an apples-to-apples comparison. If you line up the product side-by-side, price might be the same, but I think you're going to find that there's a little bit more value in the Hyundai product.
Roman Koch's got an interesting question here. He says, how long will it be before we can tell if all this onboard electronic stuff is affecting the accident rates on the road? And I'm not sure what he means, if it's distraction from all the infotainment or, you know, improvements in safety from all the electronic stuff that's in the car.
Yeah.
Like your forward collision warning, blind spot detection, all that sort of thing.
I think you hit on exactly the key point. In the infotainment space, right, the primary mission has to be to make sure we're not introducing elements that lead to greater distraction. And at the same time, there's new technologies coming into the vehicle, lane keep assist, lane departure warnings, auto emergency braking and things that, you know, technology is bringing advances in both places. And in fact, technology is making it easier to bring content into the vehicle in a less distracting way, whether it's through things like Siri eyes-free mode and things like that. At the end of the day, if we don't have technology like that built into the car, what's the customer going to do? They're going to get this out, and they're going to drive down the phone like this, drive down the road like this, right? None of us want anybody doing that.
Looking at their phone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really dangerous. So we really need to provide a solution that can solve that problem for the consumer so they're not tempted to do the really, really, really wrong thing.
Okay, here's a question for all of us. This comes from Scott in Cleveland, who says, what's the panel's view on the requirement for backup cameras in 2015 automobiles? And what's been your experience testing cars with this feature this past winter?
It's 2018 that they have to...
Mandated.
Be mandated, yeah. What surprises me is how long it took from when it was initially proposed to when it's happening. And
it's been pushed back once, right?
I think it was pushed back 3 times.
Okay.
And, you know, so the sort of like, it's like, wow. And it almost seems like the car makers were ahead of the game in terms of, you know, implementing the technology. I mean, the Fit that we couldn't talk about last week had the backup camera in it. And, you know, I mean, there's a little car that you could pretty much look over your shoulder and see the back of it. But you guys have it.
We have it in some of our cars, and we're expanding its applications. And it's more than just the automakers. I mean, it's really consumers demanding it. Once it got a little customer exposure, if you ask a customer that's had a backup camera for a while now, they're like, how did I ever live without this? It really helps me manage this, my backing up better, right?
Now, isn't it on the Veloster, you hide the camera lens behind the logo on the
Elantra GT, I think.
Oh, is it the Elantra?
GT does that. Veloster might as well, but I know specifically the Elantra GT does.
Mike, you're in a lot of cars. What do you think?
Well, two things. One, I'm surprised at the wide variety of cameras. You still have some that are really low resolution or really, you know, not a very good display.
Especially at night.
Yeah, or the ones that are up in the rearview mirror and they're this big.
Horrible.
You can't see anything out of them.
They're useless.
And then compounding that, like in the winter, all of them get covered up in snow or road salt. And I'm just amazed no one's really figured out a great solution for that. I think Nissan has some kind of system for it, but I don't know anyone else.
I don't know. I don't have the silver bullet. I'm sure it'll get better, and we're all market demand for it.
On the new Genesis, you have those headlight washers. You just have one of those little headlight washers back there.
And would raise the price accordingly.
Yeah.
No more value.
So we've got to find that balance, right?
Hey, we've got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
This is Clem Zarovsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question about the Silverado sales is, why don't they combine the GMC and Silverado sales together? Because the GMC is nothing but a Silverado with more chrome. Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye.
That's a great question, and General Motors would love for the world to report truck sales that way.
Well, this generation is more so than the interiors are exactly the same. You know, I'm sure there's some trim differences in terms of what kind of colors and combinations you get, but sheet metal and seats and dash, the only thing that that's different, I think, are the hoods and the front light treatments. They're the same truck.
Yeah, they are the same truck. But they've always been the same truck.
Yeah.
And General Motors would, and GM has even made that point in the past. Gary, if you add them up, where do they come to?
You know, it's the interesting thing is that if you look at the GMC Sierra sales, March over March, they're up 26.7%, okay? And if you look at the Silverado sales, where am I here? They're up 10.9%. So the GMC sales are up significantly more, and General Motors gets a much nicer premium off of selling a professional-grade truck than they do off a Silverado. So if you combine the two, even though you might get bragging rights in terms of sales numbers, you wouldn't get quite the margins. And I think that margins are a little bit more important than bragging rights.
Well, that may be, but I think it's very telling, and it reinforces what I've been arguing, that the Silverado has a styling problem. And the GMC, the instant you see it, you know, that's the new one. Whereas the Chevy, it's got to be, oh, let's see, are the wipers hidden behind the hood? Is the chin spoiler notched? I mean, I got to look for little clues. Like, I can't just look at the truck and go, that's the new one. So I keep saying when people buy a new truck, they want the world to know they've mm-hmm. got the new one. And I think that's hurting Chevy.
You know, and the other thing is to think about it. I mean, you could add up, like, all of their light trucks, and you'd still probably be below F-150. I mean, it's just like you're not going to beat those guys. So what does it really matter?
Let's see. We got another question here from Auto Geek, who wants to know, do Kia and Hyundai share their telematic research, or do they compete?
Trick question, right? So Hyundai and Kia are owned by the same parent company, right? And to the degree, a lot of R&D is common. There's some manufacturing processes that are shared and things like that, supply base and things like that. Yet, as a sales distribution organization in the U.S., we're competitors. We compete with them just like we would Mazda or Honda or any other brand. And we're each motivated to pursue what's in our own best interest. So when we ask our parent company for the product features and strategies and things we want for our marketplace, it's done independently, and we can't and don't collude. So I can't answer why their strategy is their strategy at all. I know that it's different than ours, and that's fine, right? That's the path they've chosen. I'm sure back at HMC headquarters in the R&D community, that's frustrating because then they've lost opportunity for commonization and things like that. And scale for parts, but it's healthy in one regard, and it goes back to the question earlier about BlueLink in different markets, right? Hyundai's a very customer use case oriented company, and if one of Hyundai Motor Group's customers is asking for a set of features, Hyundai for our market and maybe Kia for their market, they work hard to meet that request as best they can. So,
I thought Kraftcheck had the best line of the difference between Hyundai and Kia. He says, we hate them twice.
Yeah.
We hate them in the showroom, and we hate them in the boardroom.
Yeah. It's sibling rivalry, right?
Hey, but that's good.
We are certainly motivated to...
You know?
Yeah.
The competition will improve the breed.
That's right.
We got a question here, probably for Mike and Gary, from A.M. Guerrero, who writes in from the Philippines, noting that yesterday Ford finally introduced the current Escape at the Manila Auto Show, but sales don't begin until next year. And he wants to know, and it's going to be sourced from North America, he wants to know, is the Escape getting any updates for 2015? I don't know.
I haven't heard of any.
Yeah. My guess is, A.M. Guerrero, you're going to get the same Escape that we're getting right now. That's been on the market 2 years now?
2 years.
Mm-hmm. So that would suggest it's going to be another 2 years before we see some sort of refresh on that vehicle.
So they can be confident that all the bugs have been worked out and it'll be good from the start.
Okay, Barry, here's a really good one. Chris Burgess wants to know, how would telematics handle a carjacking?
I can answer that question very specifically because we had one. There was and I have to be careful here in terms of what I disclose for lots of legal reasons and customer privacy reasons, but we had a situation where there was a carjacking and there was a young woman in the car. Turned out to be her you know, boyfriend or significant other that had, you know, taken the car with her in it. And so not sure exactly of the legal definition of this situation, but law enforcement was contacted, and we helped locate the car and apprehend the suspect.
She didn't push the blue button, did she?
I don't know. I don't know who pushed the button.
Okay, here we'll make this the last question. James Welling wants to know, what's Hyundai's roadmap for autonomous driving?
I don't know for sure specifically, but I think I can comment about the space a little bit generally. The use case is pretty clear, right? There are certainly segments of society that would benefit from cars that can drive themselves, whether it's an aging population or commuters. There's scenarios where that will have relevance. It's a question of how fast the technology evolves to be able to meet the need. And I think it's going to probably be sooner than most people realize.
I'm totally with you on that comment. Totally with you. I think it is going to happen faster than most people realize. Mm-hmm. So would you develop everything in-house, or would you go with a Google, or you're not involved in that aspect?
I mean, there's a relationship to the connected vehicle strategy, right? Because for a driverless car to work, there's a couple of ways that connectivity can help that, both connecting to the cloud for map information and things like that, as well as vehicle-to-vehicle type technologies, which is a different communications protocol. But so there's a relationship, so we can kind of see where that roadmap's going. I don't know, you know, probably both, right? Probably both. It's a complex enough space that there'll be some aspects of it that we probably already have internal capability for, like the connectivity, and some other areas where we might need to leverage some outside license or technology or something like that. So,
do you know anything about the gap between, or not the gap, but the distinction between car-to-car and connected vehicle? Because, I mean, you can make the argument that why am I getting data from this car when, you know, it can just go up to the cloud and then everyone can get it? Mm-hmm. You know, cars sharing information between each other versus going to the cloud.
It's basically about the speed of information, right? And both are options. And again, I think both will exist to make that whole solution work. But in some cases, if two cars are approaching an intersection and we need to be able to detect that quickly, we may not have time to connect all the way to the cloud and back between both cars, right? So it might be more efficient, more effective to allow those cars to talk to each other via short-range communication.
You know, in terms of autonomy, the 2015 Genesis has a lot of the building blocks. I mean, it's got lane-keeping assist that's rather aggressive and will actually move the steering wheel back. Mm-hmm. You've got the smart cruise control that, you know, will adjust the speed. And so you begin to think about, okay, just additive that come sooner than later.
Yep. I drove one here tonight, and on the M14 coming from Ann Arbor over here, I was using the adaptive cruise control, the smart cruise control, and the lane keep assist as much as anything to, you know, I wanted to really personally experience and play with it and stuff like that, and it was fantastic. I mean, one of the ideas about driverless cars is that they can maintain a gap distance and have
like
more
NASCAR
even distribution.
Drafting.
Yeah, a little farther apart than that, right? Right, but you can get better traffic flow by having cars moving at a constant speed without all of this accordion effect, right? And if there's enough cars that have adaptive cruise control and lane keep assist, I think we can probably start to get in that direction, right, without having to have full autonomous cars.
Yeah. Barry, thanks so much for coming in. This has been a very interesting high-tech discussion.
Yeah, great. I've had a ball. I appreciate it.
Cool. Mike Austin. In fact, we got to tell the audience, Mike is getting married this weekend and heading out to Hawaii, so congratulations
Thanks.
On that. Great having you here again.
Great way to kick off the weekend here.
All right. And Gary, good seeing you as always, too.
See you, John.
Let's do it again next week.
Why don't we do that?
Okay.
Okay.
We will. In fact, we're going to invite all of you to join us then. And remember, you can always listen to this show in your car with all this connectivity. Just stream it through your smartphone. You can listen to it there. And send us all your tweets at twitter.com/Autoline. And join us tomorrow for Autoline Daily. And thank you for having tuned in.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.